Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Employees at Fidelity Investments got a video message from CEO Abigail Johnson today. It said the company has no tolerance for any type of harassment. Fidelity employees saw the video when they logged onto their computers today. And this comes after two former Fidelity portfolio managers left their jobs amid allegations that they sexually harassed a colleague. Last week, the company held a special employee meeting to reiterate its zero tolerance policy on harassment. And Fidelity says it's hired a consultant to review employee behavior. The national debate over sexual harassment in the workplace has grown even bigger since just last week. Today, New York's Attorney General opened a civil rights inquiry into the Weinstein Company over reports of sexual harassment and assault involving Hollywood movie mogul Harvey Weinstein. Those reports prompted thousands of women to come forward using the hashtag MeToo. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren joined them yesterday when she said this on NBC's Meet the Press.
Yes, I have a Me Too story, too. I was a baby law professor and so excited to have my first real teaching job. And there was a senior faculty member who, you know, would tell dirty jokes and make comments about my appearance. And one day he asked me if I would stop by his office, which I didn't think much about, and I did. And he slammed the door and lunged for me. It was like a bad cartoon. He's chasing me around the desk, trying to get his hands on me. And I kept saying, you don't want to do this. You don't want to do this. I have little children at home. Please don't do this. And trying to talk calmly. And at the same time, what was flickering through my brain is, if he gets hold of me, I'm going to punch him right in the face.
That's Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Also over the weekend, the New York Times reported that Fox News host Bill O'Reilly paid $32 million to settle sexual harassment allegations involving a former Fox News analyst. Well, joining us to talk about all of this is Meg Bond. She's director of the Center for Women in Work at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. She also sat on a June 2016 U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission task force that studied harassment in the workplace. Welcome, Meg.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also with us is Lee Gilmore. She's a distinguished visiting professor of women and gender studies at Wellesley. She's also the author of, quote, Tainted Witness, Why We Doubt What Women Say About Their Lives. Welcome, Lee.
Good to be with you, Deborah.
And listeners, we want to hear about your experiences. Did you contribute to the hashtag MeToo? Have you seen someone sexually harassed and did you say something? Or not? And are you surprised by this campaign? Do you think maybe some of these claims might be exaggerated? Well, call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So, Meg, let's start first, because we've got a lot of things to digest here. Let's start first with this video that was sent out by Fidelity to all Fidelity employees today. Do you think that this is helpful?
I think it's very helpful, but not enough. It's great to have a strong statement from the top. You need your leaders to make it very clear that this kind of behavior is absolutely unacceptable. And it's great that they have a consultant who's coming in, and I think not just looking at individuals, but my understanding is the consultant is coming in to look at the organizational culture. So I think her message sounds like it came swift and powerful, and that's extremely important. But it's not enough by itself, and it'd be useful to know a little bit more about what she means in terms of zero tolerance policies, because they can be somewhat of a mixed bag. But if the effort goes deeper and wider and is sustained, and gets at ways to really make it safe for targets to come forward, and makes it okay to deal with both the more subtle and blatant ways that women face harassment in the workplace. It really needs to be accompanied by more than just the strong statement to have the enduring impact that we would hope for.
And what do you say, Meg, I wonder, to folks who say, you know, this is Fidelity and this is Abigail Johnson, a woman, and, you know, we know that the workplace environment, or we've heard reported anyway, that the workplace environment at Fidelity is called a men's club, but why wouldn't it be better at a place that's overseen by a woman?
Well, you need more than just one woman at the top. There's a whole culture of the workplace. That's why it's important if these consultants come in and actually look at the whole culture. You can't just change a single individual, no matter how progressive they might be, how enlightened they might be. But the change needs to go much deeper. It needs to really look at, you know, what kinds of behaviors are tolerated day to day, not just what's litigated against in terms of a sexual harassment policy, but how are people treated on a day-to-day basis? And that starts at the top, but it's a very proactive effort is needed for it to really integrate its way into the organizational culture. So one woman at the top, great, can be progress, but it's clearly not enough. And even a few women at the top, if the culture of the organization doesn't change along with them, then it's still a hard climb to get to the kind of organization where this kind of behavior really gets taken seriously and gets addressed in a very proactive way.
Yeah, let's talk about prevalence. You know, we're certainly hearing a lot about this now. Elizabeth Warren, as we said, shared her story on Meet the Press over the weekend. Some folks say, you know, maybe that was a long time ago, right? Maybe it isn't so prevalent right now. And then on the other hand, we've got a Suffolk University Boston Globe poll out just this afternoon, surveyed 500 likely voters and found that 86% of them call sexual harassment in the workplace a problem. 1 in 4 Bostonians say that they have experienced sexual harassment. Lee Gilmore, how prevalent is this, do you think?
Well, I study accounts of sexual assault, sexual abuse that people typically are bringing forward in a written form, a memoir, an autobiography, or in a legal testimony. But I think that in terms of prevalence, what the Me Too campaign highlighted for many people was the scale of the phenomenon. And I think that when you begin to listen to stories of sexual harassment, sexual abuse, and sexual assault, you see that women's experience of sexual violence and sexual aggression persists across their lifespan and across all the locations in which they live. So it's a workplace issue, certainly, but it's broader than that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we're really having this new moment of visibility in which longer histories of sexual harassment are being heard. So women are often saying, in my first job, this is what happened. Then when I was in my 30s, this happened. And then they might have a Senator Warren story where there's a single incident that occurs in yet another workplace. So in terms of prevalence, it's not just how many people are affected, it's how frequently they're affected.
And here's what I wonder. If this is what we're hearing about now, these very overt stories about really assault in many cases, what about the things that are not so obvious? What about the woman passed over for a promotion or not getting a raise? What about those kinds of things? Can you draw a line and say, if this is happening, therefore this must be happening as well, but we just haven't measured it yet?
That's a really great point. It's, sometimes we see egregious examples. Sometimes we see subtle examples. But I think that organizational cultures are often permeated by interlocking and supporting behaviors. And some cultures are particularly hard to desegregate in terms of gender and racial diversity, especially when what's valued in that culture is a kind of boundary pushing or risk taking, in which the downsides for that activity are different for men and for women. So women might be passed over for promotions because they don't seem to be as aggressive or seem to be pushing the envelope as much. And men might still get a promotion even if they have failed in taking those risks. But the penalties and the rewards get gendered, I think.
Hmm. Well, I want to remind listeners that we want to hear about your experiences as well. Did you contribute to the hashtag MeToo? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. You know, I also want to make sure that we mention here about the Bill O'Reilly news over the weekend and the $32 million settlement. And Megyn Kelly talked about this a little bit on her show this morning. Megyn Kelly Today. And she talked about the culture at Fox News in general. Let's listen.
Fox News was not exactly a friendly environment for harassment victims who wanted to report, in my experience. However, O'Reilly's suggestion that no one ever complained about his behavior is false. I know because I complained.
And Lee Gilmore, I want to go back to you with this because this is, I think, a little bit about what you were talking about, sort of why why folks don't necessarily believe what women say. I mean, Megyn Kelly was a star at Fox News, and certainly what we're hearing about happening at Fox News, and yet she still feels like her opinions, her complaints, her concerns were kind of pushed aside here. Is that an accurate reading, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, when we look at accounts of sexual harm in the public sphere, we frequently see that they are greeted by doubt. Independent of any particular account, we have pre-made narratives of doubting women. So they're default cultural narratives of doubt. One of those is nobody knew what was really going on, which is a way of exonerating those who should have reacted and those who shouldn't have taken advantage. And we also have the he said, she said notion of false equivalence, that it's a man's word against a woman. But I think one thing that Megyn Kelly's clip there just shows is we're past the nobody knew, nobody complained moment. I think that now looks more like the false narrative that it is. Mm. Bill O'Reilly had a settlement before he had a contract extension, that Harvey Weinstein wasn't charged by the DA, the same DA who didn't charge Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who also had a very public sexual assault case brought against him. These ideas, you know, the idea that maybe that's not so pervasive, I think we're past that. The idea that nobody knew, I think we're past that too. So I do think there's a shift going on.
Yeah, we heard there was a really controversial Facebook post, actually, from screenwriter Scott Rosenberg after the Harvey Weinstein story broke. And he said, you know, he's a local guy. He said, I stayed silent and everybody knew what was happening with Weinstein. Mm-hmm. He said, but nobody wanted to upset the gravy train, so to speak. Nobody was going to say something when their livelihoods were on the line. Is that a common argument, do you think? Meg, what would you say about that?
Sure, yeah. I think that's a very common argument, and I think that's extremely important when we look at Fidelity as well. There are people who are superstars, that are the rainmakers, the people who organizations feel they can't do without. And those folks are often given a lot of latitude, and people just turn a blind eye to what it tends to be common knowledge, but they operate under this belief that if we lose this star, that we're all going to be at stake, we're all going to lose money, we all won't have the outcomes we want, when in fact, you mentioned the EEOC report, there are a lot of costs to not recognizing this kind of behavior for organizations. And there should be a lot of motivation, even when there are superstars and rainmakers, that it's still costly for an organization not to to confront it. So
costly why? Costly why? Well, costly why? Like,
costly why? Well, you've got the lawsuits, but you also have the costs in terms of the loss of talent for the people who will avoid the organization because of the culture, the loss of productivity of other people. There's evidence that not only do the targets of harassment suffer in terms of job satisfaction and job productivity, but so do their coworkers who know that it's going on and that it's not being addressed. There can be a tremendous lack of or loss of morale. And all of those affect productivity and what really the bottom line ultimately.
I'd like to get some callers in because our lines are full. So let's go to Jill, who's calling from Natick. Jill, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. So I have my Me Too story, which I did share online on Facebook. But when I was a graduate student, this is about 15 years ago, I was a young graduate student, and multi-Oscar-winning A-list director came and spoke to our class. And at a party for him afterwards, he groped me. And I was not the only one, comparing stories later, that this happened to. And thank God it was not a rape or a more physical sexual assault. So I feel very grateful for that. But I remember sort of freezing and feeling really icky and gross and ashamed, but also somewhat feeling a little bit like, wow, I got the attention of this rich, powerful, older man. And I feel as if we really need to, in addition to dealing with the issue of sexual assault by men, we also need to institute a broader systemic change where we make sure that young women and women of all ages don't feel that their worth is measured in these sexual, you know, advances by men. I feel like we really need to teach our daughters and our young women coming up that this is not a measure of your desirability or of some kind of power that you have. This is actually a power assault by these men.
Did you say anything, Jill, to this, you know, Oscar-winning director?
I did at the time. I said, hey, you know, and he said, oh, sorry. And my professor said, oh, that's just the way he is. You know, he has that reputation. It's Hollywood, you know. And that was pretty much it. And then remembering that same professor a couple of years later when I was pregnant made comments about the size of my breasts when I was pregnant. So, I mean, it was sort of trying to get my point across to somebody who was already very much in that that mindset of more powerful older men preying on younger women.
All right, Jill, thanks for the call. I also want to hear from Louise, who's calling from West Roxbury. Louise, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a very short little story. My supervisor was being roasted for a retirement party, and there were a number of us that were going to sing a song for him. And when he caught wind of it, in front of many people, many tables of people, he looked at me and he said, oh, I hear you're going to sing. Do I get a lap dance with that? And, you know, it seems like such a benign comment, but I was horrified, embarrassed, hurt. And then to make matters worse later on, I had colleagues that couldn't understand why I thought that was such a heinous remark.
Right. Right.
And it gets back to the previous caller talking about, well, all of the program talking about the culture, and that making some sort of sexual innuendo for a man to do that towards a woman is just uncalled for, but it's so prevalent.
Well, that's an interesting point, Louise. And, you know, to go along with that, I want to play a piece of tape here from former Rhode Island State Representative Joe DiLorenzo. He spoke with a radio station in Newport after a group of mostly female Democrats called on him to resign from his post as second vice chair of the state Democratic Party. Let's listen to what he had to say.
Everything is sexual harassment today. If a woman walks in my office and I say to her, boy, you look very nice in that dress. Sexual harassment. A woman walks in that I know and I put your arm around her, give her a kiss on the cheek. Sexual harassment. Sexual harassment.
That is former Rhode Island State Rep Joe DiLorenzo. I'm wondering, Lee Gilmore, weigh in on that here. I mean, seriously, though, is there some sort of generational difference here about what's appropriate and how do we define it?
Well, I think he's giving a good definition of sexual harassment.
I don't think that's what he's trying to do, though.
Right. Well, I think one of, you know, what we're seeing here with this sort of claim that I'm from a different generation or I meant it in a lighthearted way is actually a form of resistance to women's full participation in the public sphere and the ability to take up a kind of rightful place in workspaces, in public life, in civic life, and in our daily lives as well, that there is some kind of ownership over women, over our bodies, over our dignity, over our autonomy that can be wielded against a woman wherever she is because she's a woman, that there's a right to that. And I think that also is coming to an end. And so when a woman is at a workplace function, whether that's in the holiday party, or that is a retirement dinner, or that dinner afterwards with the lecturer at a university, that is being at work for those women. And appropriate professional decorum should be observed, but minimally a woman should be able to expect to have a kind of right to be there and not be harassed.
So is it harassment only if the person in power is making the comments or doing something that's objectionable?
No, people within organizations can harass each other laterally, and Meg probably can speak to that with specificity.
Meg?
Well, yes, and there are two types of harassment, one that's quid pro quo harassment and one that's hostile environment harassment, and that's defined by the EEOC. So the real blatant quid pro quo is really the threat, if you do this, then you'll get that, or if you don't do this, I'll punish you in this way. But there's hostile work environment harassment, which are the kinds of behaviors that make women feel simply unwelcome or second tier, or like Lee was saying, their attention is to them for their bodies, not for their competence. The naked pictures of women on the calendars on the walls, mm-hmm. all of those together, if they create an environment that is hostile to women, that still can fit within the definition of sexual harassment. But I think there's another piece of the picture here that's really important, is that we have to, and I think Lee was alluding to this too a little bit, we have to pay attention to behaviors that don't necessarily meet the legal requirement, because it's not all about catching the bad guys. It's really about changing the whole culture of how women are treated at work. And that sometimes is addressing issues that don't necessarily meet a formal legal definition. If a workplace really wants to address the problem, they've got to be really coaching their employees around what is civil, what is collegial, what is paying attention to people for their competencies and not their bodies or characteristics that are completely irrelevant to the quality of the work. And even if those don't bubble up to a legal definition, they're still problematic and they still have to be addressed.
But identifying them is a huge problem. I want to just make sure we get a few more callers in before we end the conversation here. Molly is calling from Norton. Molly, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, so I did use the Me Too hashtag as well, basically because I have been sexually harassed at every single job I've worked at since I was age 18. I'm 31 now, and that's like a total of 5 jobs, I think. So it's just, it's a pervasive problem. It doesn't matter what industry you're in. It's everywhere. And I had reported instances of sexual harassment in the first few jobs. However, the investigations turned out to be inconclusive, and then I was forced to work in the same environment with the same person. So I just learned early on that it's just better off to not say anything and continue on working where at least there's some peace kept.
All right. Molly, thanks so much for the call. We also have Peter who's calling from Wayland. And, Peter, we want to get a man in this conversation. So you're on the air. Tell us what's up.
Well, I sympathize with the women suffering from this, and I know it's greater. As a young undergrad, I was sexually harassed by a professor who in one evening put his hand on my thighs 6 times. And I was so grateful to have someone take interest in what I thought was my when I first received this invitation. It's not just women, men certainly need to learn where to stand up for themselves. I'm glad that Harvard has prohibited professor-undergraduate relationships.
Mm-hmm. And so did you report it?
I went to a person to report it. I talked with friends. I went to the person who reported, who happened to be the university chaplain. Again, also a gay man, and I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with someone making a pass at me. But he was the chaplain and hitting on me, and it disheartened me. The fact that the professor would do it 6 times, I mean, you come to a university to learn about justice and something that's decent, and this person had no respect for me as a human at all.
All right, Peter, unfortunately we're running out of time. I want to thank you very much. I just want to get final thoughts here just briefly from Lee and from Meg. Are we seeing the start of something here, Lee, would you say, that folks are thinking about this and they're weighing the risks of reporting and thinking that maybe it is time to stand up and to say things and to say, you know what, even if there's a culture here where I may be risking my livelihood in the future, I'm going to do this because it's more important. Are we there yet?
Well, we have this new moment of visibility, and in that moment, we're able to connect the dots, and we can see that this has been a problem for a long time, and this affects so many people. And as more and more people bring their stories forward, we begin to understand better what the harms are and the forms that the harassment takes. And as each person's voice is amplified, I think that we begin to hear something new in political life. And the new element in political life that I'm hearing is a groundswell of decency from the survivors of these sexual assaults. And the last caller just said we came to college to learn about justice. And I think that this new voice that's testifying to harm that's been done is also calling out for justice.
And Meg, final thought. Last word goes to you, but we've got about 20 seconds.
Well, let me just say, I hope we're at a tipping point. But we do have to remember that right after Anita Hill had her testimony about Clarence Thomas, reports of sexual harassment went up
like 26 years ago.
And that was a short-lived moment. So we've got to do more than just have faith that this is a tipping point. We need to really rally whole communities to address this. We need everybody, not just the victims, to stand up, but we need everybody who senses it, who sees it, who's a bystander in any way, shape, or form, to be a collective voice. Remember the callers reported that they didn't feel believed. They need to be believed. They need their colleagues, their friends, their coworkers, their bosses, their teachers to take them seriously they raise these issues.
Meg Bond is a professor of psychology and director of the Center for Women in Work at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. Thanks for being with us, Meg.
Thank you.
Lee Gilmore is a distinguished visiting professor of women's and gender studies at Wellesley. She's also author of the book Tainted Witness, Why We Doubt What Women Say About Their Lives. Lee, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Deborah.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.